is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builders Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, wine in the Umpqua program on today's Inside Douglas County. Dyson DeMara here from Hillcrest Vineyards, Paul O'Brien Winery, and a plethora of other wine interests around the area. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. And Merry Christmas to you as well as everybody out in the audience.
So wine for the holidays, you know, it's been interesting as people are looking at whatever they're doing this year, and everybody's kind of got their own way of going about events this year. But people want to have, oftentimes, even if they don't normally drink wine, want to offer a complimentary wine with their holiday meal, whether we're actually talking Christmas Day or we're talking some casual gathering between now and then. And a lot of people look around and go, I have no idea what I'm doing. So we kind of wanted to start there. How do you know what wine to pick for those big holiday meals?
Well, first of all, I'm gonna correct the wine to wines. One of the great things about the holiday is if you were sharing the table with quite a few people, family and loved ones and friends, is actually drinking many different wines. And it's an awesome experience to share wine. It's actually far preferable. Kind of a little side note, we have recently we had a little group together. We went up to the Secret Wine Society in Oakland, which has a really great wine list in that. And there were about eight of us, and we drank six different wines, and it was enough for like a nice glass of each wine. And that's so fantastic. And it's the same thing is true with food. Like a mixed grill tastes far better than just a steak or just a piece of chicken kind of thing. So I would say, number one, open it up to a lot of different things, different styles and flavors and that. A lot of it has to do with, like when I was raised, we always had ribeye roast, and we still do that out of tradition at our house and that. But, in today's world, so many people, I know people have sushi, people do all kinds of different things that you really, have to look at it. There's many different ways. I used to teach a little bit of wine and food pairing as it applied to restaurants and trying to teach wait staff to help people select a wine in that. And there are many different, it's almost endless the number of theories on wine and food pairing. There's complementary, contrasting. I go on and on and on. But the one thing that I think is the constant in the norm has a lot to do with texture. And this is something we use with food and other beverages and that when you have a peanut butter cookie, we always talk about, it'd be nice to have a cold glass of milk. Well, peanut butter cookies are creamy, the texture. Milk is creamy, so those two things complement one another. And texture is really a driving factor. You can take something like a piece of chicken and have it with like a citrus sauce, and something like Sauvignon Blanc that's a very kind of lean, crisp white wine can be beautiful. Or you can take that same chicken breast and make some type of a cream sauce and have something like a Chardonnay that tends to be creamier in texture. And so that texture is really, I think, the go-to thing for me when I look at like actual wine and food pairing. But having said that, like we'll probably have 10-12 people at our table this Christmas, and everybody will be of drinking age and love wines and that. And we'll probably open 6, 7, 8 bottles of wine, and every bottle will be different from the last, and it'll represent a lot of different styles because we'll have people, it's also how you use wine. There'll be, as we're preparing wine in the kitchen, people are hanging out in the kitchen, certain wines and that. And as we go to the table, sparkling wine is always a no-brainer. It's one of the great things in the holiday, kind of, especially with everything we've gone through here in the last, couple of years and that, to have a little something bubble to kind of celebrate and kind of take us out of that mode and hopefully new beginnings and that. But it's hard to limit it, but I think it's good to fall back on a rule and things that you like. And sometimes it's a question of things that you know. There are certain times you want, like, I love this wine, I'd like to have that wine. There are other times that you want to have range. And so, like, in our tasting room this time of year, we spend a lot of time. We try to be the most educational tasting in the Umpqua Valley. When we prepare, we serve wines, we don't just talk about Umpqua or that grape variety. We talk about the world context, the flavors of that variety, foods that it goes with. And that's something we like to do in the tasting room, is when people come in and say, oh, we're having this for dinner on Christmas Eve or whatever, as we walk people through and say, these are some different options.
And, one of the things you mentioned there, too, with these longer, oftentimes, meals is that idea of going multiple directions, even if you really, have got one that you really want with the main course.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to think about, it's At the point, I think wine really becomes part of your life. You're not drinking wine as just like a table beverage. Wine is something that, you know, my wife and I oftentimes will come in and, like, as we start to prepare dinner, we have, you know, a glass of wine or two or something and sit down on the couch for a little bit and, you know, finish cooking, go to the table and then finish the bottle, you know, on the couch. And so it's really, wine is like a way of life instead of, you know, I was raised in a family that had no alcohol in the home for religious reasons and that. And so I looked at it initially as like, okay, you have this wine with this food, this wine with this food. And it's gotten to be really, it's moods. And once you've had enough wine, it's kind of like food that, you know, once you've eaten a lot of different ethnic foods and that, it's kind of what you're in the mood for. It's just kind of almost a reaction. And I always joked when I used to travel quite a bit,
Back when people traveled.
Yeah, that's when people traveled, yeah. At Robert Mondavi and that, I spent a lot of time with our regional reps, you know, in America and overseas and that. And the people that really didn't drink wine on a daily basis would usually order the food and then kind of go through the list. And I could always tell the real hardcore wine drinkers, because they would be on the company expensive count, of course. And the first thing they'd ask for is, I want to see the wine list. And they'd order the wine, and then they'd order their dinner.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, people are traveling again. I'm actually working on two different trips right now for the next few months. So I think maybe, you know, as I walked into this, you know, starting in 2006, trying to learn some of this, it's almost like those high society rules of, you know, not wearing white after Labor Day or, you know, things like that. And it's too easy to get caught in those and maybe not experiment a bit.
Yeah. It's so interesting culturally. You know, we are a culture that came from, I mean, most of us are European, so our ancestors came from the old world drinking wine and beer, came to the United States, we experienced Prohibition, and I think to a great extent people, you know, the people that came to the East Coast and then eventually the West Coast were hardworking people that, you know, everything was about getting ahead, building whatever you were doing, so we didn't really sit around and smell the roses very often. And so you look at really like the 70s, late 70s and 80s is when wine becomes a little bit more high profile. I mean, people were drinking wine before this, but it was Carlo Rossi jug wine under the counter next to the bathroom cleaning supplies. You know, once a year you'd crack that sucker open and pour everybody a glass for Christmas. And so that has very much changed. And so we look at it, you know, technically, okay, what wine do I have? And I think that it, like a lot of things, if you're not familiar with them, you have to immerse yourself a little bit and kind of just pay attention to what's out there. But there's a point not too long thereafter that you become comfortable with, I like this, I like this. And the most important thing is to always keep an open mind, because what happens is we always talk about how wines change. People's palates change far more dramatically than wine. And we see this with spirits, and most people are more familiar with it with spirits, that if you look at, like, when somebody's 21, they really don't like the taste of alcohol at all. So you're drinking things like pina coladas and margaritas where the flavors are drowned by sugar and fruity flavors. And then very slowly we develop a flavor for that. And we go to a gin and tonic, which is watered down, of course. Then we go to a martini, which is, you know, pretty much straight up gin with a little something to kind of cover it. And then the way you go from white wine to red wine, you go from white spirits to brown spirits. And brown spirits, the flavor of the oak and also what makes it brown, is very, very complex. And that's too much for people to handle in the beginning. Your brain is just not used to those flavors, but it's something you develop a flavor for. So, you know, by the time you're 40, 50, 60 years old, oftentimes people will be, you know, sipping on single malt scotch, neat, you know, just a little bit of it, a couple fingers in a glass or something like that. And so there's that evolution. And so, you know, it used to be things were more judgmental. Wine was something that, you know, they're the wine expert kind of thing. I think wine is much more mainstream, and it's going to be very interesting. This next generation, as we go into, you know, millennials, I think the oldest millennials in their early 40s, if I'm not wrong, you know, they've thrown all that out. Forget the wine expert. I don't want to listen to the wine expert. I don't want to drink what my parents drank. And I'm more likely to get on some type of an app sitting at a bar in Portland and communicating with somebody I've never met at the other end of the bar saying, oh, you've got to try this great German Riesling that's on the list. And so that's very much the future. And to me, that is so exciting because, you know, there are somewhere between 4,000 and 8,000 grape varieties in the world. We've been somewhat had our hands tied in the New World because we took initially the French and the German, the most famous varieties, the Italian varieties, the most famous. But there's all kinds of varieties we've never played with. And for example, you know, we have some programs, we do some Italian varietals. There's a handful of those grown here in Umpqua Valley. There's 2,800 varieties in the ground in Italy, unique to Italy. And so, you know, it's just this next generation that's, they'll want different. And it's what I say, the microbrew generation, that they're used to going into the same microbrewery, and every time they go in, they have a different beer. That's pretty hard to do with wine. But the thing is, that opens the door to hear something new and different. It doesn't have to be the Chardonnay Reserve, Cabernet Reserve.
And, you know, just last week, and I don't remember where I got it, I had gotten a blend, and I can't remember what country it originated from. But what was interesting was there were two varietals I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
I think they were either Italian or Spanish, mm-hmm. just based on the foods, mm-hmm. on the spelling. So that was mm-hmm. kind of interesting. Yeah. One of the other aspects, too, for people that are working on diets and things like that, a lot of times people during the holiday season, diets go out the window. But if you're trying to not do that, what do you need to know about how many calories are in a glass of wine?
Yeah, save your calories, or use these up, I should say. So it really doesn't differ that much. Calories come from two places in wine. If it's a dry wine, it's purely from the alcohol itself. And let's say there's 100 to 110 calories, roughly, in a glass of wine. If you have residual sugar in a wine, there'll be some of those calories. That's basically sugar from the grape that wasn't converted over to alcohol, so you're still going to use that energy up somewhere. That can be a little bit sweeter. Oftentimes, it's exactly the same, because once again, you don't have as much alcohol because of that residual sugar. So it's, I think the low alcohol wines, if I'm not wrong, are something that they're, you know, like 9% alcohol, 90 calories kind of thing. And so you're really, if you're saving 10 calories, 20 calories, I don't know that that's worth it. You know, there's other ways, probably cutting back on your portions a little bit, that would be more of a hammer. Wines, you know, there's been different research in this, and the most interesting thing is that people that drink wine, you tend to absorb more calories, but it's not from the wine. It's that you tend to eat more food. Mm. And so wine, there's an old French saying, wine is a eunuch without food, and wine makes food taste better. So if you look at a lot of very famous cookbooks and that, they always talk about, oh, if something's missing, squeeze a lemon at it. A lot of chefs will do this. And acidity pops flavor. When people put vinaigrettes on oysters, or you take a piece of fish, you squeeze a lemon on it, that acidity, kind of balsamic vinegar on things, kind of pops flavors. You get more taste. You also get more taste is that the older you are, the less saliva you have in your palate. And the saliva is what transfers flavors from food to your taste buds and that. And so the thing is that when you have a glass of wine, it forces you, because the acidity, to salivate, and you get more flavor out of the food. And I've seen this as I've gotten older. I'm in my mid-50s now, and that my palate has dried up a little bit. And I'll tell you, just having food, it's rare, but sometimes we'll sit down, my wife and I, and we'll be at some event, and maybe there's no wine there or whatnot, and just having our dinner with a glass of water and a glass of milk, it's like half the flavor's missing. And that sounds like a really bizarre thing, but it's kind of like eating with your nose pinched, where you can't taste the stuff.
Dyson Damara back with more Wine in the Empire on Inside Douglas County. The interview, a podcast after one at 541radio.com, 1248 at News Radio 1240, KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1250 at News Radio 1240 KQEN. Lars Larson at 1, Shannon Sebastian with your cue, part of KQEN Local Talk at 4. State Representative Christine Goodwin on tomorrow's Inside Douglas County. Dyson Damara from, okay, let's see if we can go through the list here. Hillcrest Vineyards, Paul O'Brien Winery, and you have more.
Yes, we took over the old Misty Oaks a number of years ago, Pazzo Colina, which is a vineyard. We're planting more vineyard out there, kind of dedicated to Italian varietals. And then we acquired in January of this year the old Tesso Aria Giuliana vineyard down off of Old Hess Lane that is a way of obtaining some interesting varieties that have great histories in Umpqua Valley. That vineyard, not what's there now, but that property was first planted by Dino Danino of Dino's Restaurant, who worked at Hillcrest with Richard Summers and took some of those varieties over. So there are varieties. I mean, if you came here in the 70s, early 70s, things like Semillon, Chenin Blanc were very popular. Chenin Blanc is what Chardonnay is today. I mean, nobody really knew Chardonnay by the early 70s. That Chenin Blanc was everywhere. Napa Valley made Chenin Blanc more than any other white wine. Gamay, which is the fastest growing variety in terms of acres in the state of Oregon as a percentage, I should say. It's off a small base, but Gamay used to be grown a lot in Oregon. For whatever reason, there's a lot of interest, especially in the northern Willamette, in Gamay. So so we have a few different properties. A lot of it's grape sourcing that long-term, and we're still quite a ways from that, as you
as an industry matures, and I saw this happen in Napa Valley where we had our vineyard, is that you'll have vineyards that maybe it's just somebody that's a grower that sells to 20 wineries. Well, pretty soon a very well-established winery will come in and take over that vineyard. They take in all that fruit. And you'll literally have wineries that are built on pulling four or five different varieties out of one particular property, and they've maybe developed a reputation for that over 10 or 20 years, and now that fruit is totally gone. And in places like that, it's hard to go source fruit. And so as we run across things that are very interesting to us, we try long-term to acquire them, and it's just so that you have a constant fruit source. And also, if you can, it's nice to grow it. I mean, it's contrary to what a lot of people say, it's not important that you own it. It's good business to own property. The most important thing is location, that it be a really, really good location. And the great locations of the world grow one, two, three things great, and then they grow a lot of other things. So when you figure, when you find out or discover that certain varieties do really, really well in a pocket, it's very interesting to kind of from a long-term perspective. And this is a... it's an industry that, you know, I've been fortunate enough to work for families that have been in the business, you know, 300 years, 800 years, and that's fairly common in Europe. And so the thing is, you don't go into Tuscany and just go buy fruit today. You couldn't just go start up a winery and buy high quality fruit. Those vineyards have been sucked up and absorbed by these estates, you know, 200, 300, 400, 500 years ago. And someday I think, you know, Umpqua Valley will be the same thing. Real estate will be the same thing here, that it's just everything that's really good is spoken for, and it's only the fringe sites that sell.
Are you seeing more interest in acquiring land here, whether it's for a winery or for sourcing from folks in other parts of Oregon or other nearby states?
Yeah, there always is interest, and I'd say it builds over time. It's, you know, we don't have any land rush here at this point, but we're beginning to see, and I think it's part of the cycle, the investment cycle within the wine business. You're starting to see other people secure grape sourcing. We've had, you know, a couple of handoffs this year of vineyards. Probably the most important and significant was the Red Hill Vineyard, which is up in Rice Hill, which was one of the largest vineyards in the county at, I think, about 250 acres. And that was purchased by a gentleman very well established up in the north that took on partners here locally take that vineyard, replant it, and bring it back on. And then, but we're beginning, there's a sale that's going to close here fairly soon after the first of the year, if all goes according to plan, that will be a winery a lot of you are familiar with that will change hands. So we're beginning to see that. There's also, you know, in the very beginning, you have people that, you know, have experience from somewhere else and come in, and they kind of know what they're getting into. But also, you have a lot of people in a new industry where the barrier to entry is so low in terms of cost, and that is that people get in, and then once they get in, they kind of see that it's not really a retirement job. I mean, the wine industry is a newborn baby, and you're in agriculture, you're in production, you're in marketing, and there's never really downtime to go. There's always something that needs to be done, and that calendar gets filled. Well, a lot of people dream about retiring into the wine business. They get into that, and they realize they have a tiger by the tail, and so you see people in their 60s that get into it. By the time they're 70, the winery's for sale, and we're going to begin to see a little bit of that as that first kind of generation of a lot of these wineries are kind of going out. But it's nice because we are beginning to see more kind of experience. And so the challenge for any new wine region globally is not the best wine you make, it's the worst wine you make. And so the thing is that what Napa and like New Zealand have going for them is that people might open a wine list in a restaurant and they don't know any of the wineries, but they know the region, and they know the wines from that region tend to be very consistent, good quality. And so in a new region where you have all kinds of new places, new varieties, new people doing this, that's the challenge, is consistent quality. And so in time, you have to bring that bottom up, and, you know, experience helps. And if you don't have the experience, a lot of people in Napa Valley don't have the experience, but they have the money to go buy the experience.
So a year past Archie Creek, how did things pan out in this year's harvest versus last?
Yeah, so I mean, 2020 was a crazy harvest. You know, I think the state was off 33%, which in agriculture is monster. In the wine business, that's a monster. It's hard to make up in that. We had some smoke issues in that with 2020, and so everybody's trying to compensate for that. This year, there's in agriculture, we always say there's no two years that are the same. And this year was actually a super ideal year. There is a that the really hot weather that we had, the dryness we had, made a fingerprint on certain varieties. So it's interesting when people say, oh, this is a good vintage, bad vintage. You can say that sometimes about a given variety. You can't say that about a bunch of varieties. So, you know, if you drive around vineyards and you look at like the vineyards down in the valley floors, the Pinot Noir, you'll see that stuff pushes and starts growing really early, but also ripens really early. If you look at like some of the Cabernet up on a hillside or something like that, that stuff might get picked out, you know, 6-8 weeks later from the very first harvest of Pinot Noir. And so that weather, when you have kind of challenging weather, it can affect different grapes differently. So like last year, Malbec and Tempranillo, we had a little bit of rain at flowering. And so that meant like a reduction of about maybe 40 to 50% of the berries on the cluster, potential berries, were never pollinated. So it was a very, very light crop. Pinot Noir was beautiful, you know, very complete. It's an easy vintage to make into super beautiful wines. Other varieties, that wasn't the case. What's interesting is, you know, I have almost 40 vintages under my belt, and usually a hot, dry year like last year makes very big, powerful wines. You tend to have berries that are smaller, thicker skins as that fruit's trying to protect moisture, and that, therefore you get more color, power, flavor. We have a lot of color, but what's so interesting is that last year, some of the bigger reds are much more elegant and delicate and very perfumey red, and I can't explain why that is. That kind of defies what my experience and others' experiences have been. So that's the magic of wine, is every wine, great wine should tell a story.
Dyson DeBara, out of time. We could go on for a long time, but here comes the hook. We got to go. Thanks for coming in.
Always a great pleasure.
1257 at News Radio 1240 KQEN.
You've been listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN, a daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications, your home for Douglas County's news team, News Radio 1240 KQEN.